You're listening to the News Project Podcast for the week of August 9th, 2021, brought to you by GNAT TV. This podcast brings you these two stories. CUD and Consolidated to seek broadband funding and Rural Revival.
The Southern Vermont Communications Union District, one of the CUDs that have emerged over the past year to help facilitate bringing modern levels of broadband and internet service to currently unserved or underserved homes and addresses, has reached a memorandum of understanding with Consolidated Communications, an internet and telephone company which has been one of the internet service providers in northern New England for several years, to begin the planning which both sides hope will eventually lead to offering the underserved addresses in Bennington County modern levels of broadband service. The first step in the process is for both parties to apply and receive a federal grant known as an NTIA grant, short for National Telecommunications and Information Administration, a federal agency that's part of the U.S. Department of Commerce. If approved, the grant will help pay for the design and the deployment of fiber optic cable to all addresses in the CUD that currently do not have access to modern internet service, where up to now it hasn't been economically viable for private firms like CCI to run wire. We had a chance to speak with Eric Garr, the president of Consolidated Communications Consumer and Small Business, about the agreement and the Memorandum of Understanding, which the CUD's board of directors approved during a meeting on July 28th.
Yeah, right now the team is hard at work getting the grant application ready for NTIA, which is the federal agency that is distributing funds that the CUD wants to compete for. So part of our work with them is we're doing a lot of the planning work and documentation of what would be required to serve the unserved addresses so that we can submit a competitive grant request in the next couple of weeks. Yeah, I think, you know, it's a partnership. And what we expect is much of what we'll do will be building networks and serving customers just like we do elsewhere in Vermont. And their role will be as a new kind of government agency that will provide some oversight and some advice as we seek to do that in that community. You know, we have assets in the area already because we have a fiber network that serves some businesses in the area. So that gives us a little bit of a head start, which I'm not sure some of our competitors have. I think the other asset we have is we're building in Vermont today. So we've passed more than 30,000 homes on our way to 50,000 homes to pass with fiber in Vermont this year. So we're not starting from scratch. This is really about planning our deployment for next year. And we have teams in the field doing work today. So I think that's another advantage that we have. And I think that the third one is it's not an advantage yet, but I think it's an opportunity. We're a different company than we were a year ago. We have new investors. There's some new leaders, myself included. And we think that gives us a chance to really, really grow as a company, improve our service, kind of come into the next century with a great fiber network across northern New England. And we're on our way to doing that.
We also met up with Sheila Kearns, the clerk of the Southern Vermont CUD, to get their side of the story.
What is happening next, or is happening right at this moment, is the very labor-intensive process of applying for the NTIA grant. Our procurement process and the memorandum of understanding was one of the required precursors for applying for this grant. And the CUD board members worked very hard to pull this together in a very short amount of time, as well as the partner we have reached an agreement with, Consolidated Communications. So that is what our that is what our focus is for the next 2 weeks before the grant deadline hits. If the opportunity arises while we're doing this work to talk about terms of a contract with Consolidated that would be put in place before the grant monies could be used or spent, we would do that as well. But I think we have enough on our plate just trying to get the NTIA grant together. What will happen with the grant is that the funds we request in that final amount that will be determined as we proceed through the application and the details of precisely what our project will involve comes about. But the funds will be granted to the Communication Union District. And then the Communication Union District would apply those funds to a contract that will be developed with Consolidated in order to bring fiber-based internet service to the agreed upon addresses in our district where Consolidated currently offers service. Those addresses are addresses where, to our knowledge, with the various sources of information that we have, those are addresses where there is no internet service offering anything greater than 25.3. In other words, 25 megabits of speed when you're receiving information from the internet, and 3 megabits of speed when you are sending information out into the internet. So if you live in a place where the only means of your, in our CUD, where the only means of getting internet is through DSL, then in all likelihood, that is where the fiber will start appearing.
The COVID pandemic brought home to many the importance and necessity of high-speed modern broadband service, as remote work, remote learning, and other services like telemedicine became necessities. The NTIA grant is separate from the ARPA, or American Rescue Plan Act, which is also directing federal funds to help wire up rural and underserved areas. The next steps envisioned, and once initial planning is complete, would be the actual laying of internet infrastructure next year, possibly in the spring, depending on weather conditions. For the GNet TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. One of the recurring themes of political, social, economic, and cultural discussion in recent years has been the growing divide between rural and urban areas. In recent years, cities and their surrounding suburbs have been the sites and sources of most of the economic and population growth in the United States. The technology economy has also given a strong push to this, as high-paying jobs tended to cluster in urban areas like Boston, New York, San Francisco, and Silicon Valley. But that's not the only driver of this trend. As we've seen in recent years in Vermont, the population growth has stagnated and gotten older on average, as younger residents moved out of state to seek better-paying career opportunities than they were finding at home. Has the pandemic altered this equation? It may be too early to tell, despite the surge in real estate buying and the rise of remote work, which has led to a certain number of city dwellers moving to more rural locations. Time will tell us if this trend will continue and grow. But for an analysis of what is going on with the rural-urban divide, we spent some time in recent weeks talking with a group of Vermonters who bring a broad perspective to this question of what is the future looking like for rural areas. Are we poised for a new round of growth and becoming attractive places to live, or not? And when and how did this bifurcation occur? We started with Matt Dunn, who is the founder and executive director of CORI, the Center on Rural Innovation, a nonprofit organization based in Heartland, Vermont, and which was founded in 2017 to address the dramatic opportunity gap between rural and urban areas that they believe grew out of the Great Recession of 2008-2009. They are seeking to advance economic prosperity in rural America through the creation of digital economy ecosystems that support entrepreneurship and tech job creation.
I mean, this is something that happens every 100 years or so, interestingly, is that there has been moments when rural places have had disproportionate value to the economy of a place because of natural resources or lower cost labor. And then there are moments where suddenly there's a massive divide that emerges. And the most recent divide can be looked at as starting around the 2008 recession. And there are some factors that made that a particularly important turning point. And one was the increase in automation that had started to take off, the increase in globalization, which was facilitated by technology, allowing for supply chains to be with anyone anywhere in the world, not just an outpost in a rural place that was a drive or a quick flight away. And the third was the decline of entrepreneurship for the 30 years prior to 2008, that was particularly pronounced in rural America, which had been a font of entrepreneurs, of people who were inventing new things because they needed them and there wasn't anyone else to help solve the problem for them, that led to new innovations on the farm, which sometimes led to things like washing machines, right? And so, and that's where Maytag, you know, was created. So there is a series of factors that just came together in the lead up to 2008. And then when 2008 recession hit, automation increased because companies were looking for lower cost ways to be able to create goods and services. Globalization increased, partially from policy, but also because they were looking for lower cost ways to deliver products and services. And when you didn't have entrepreneurship, you didn't have the farm team of companies to come in behind the ones that naturally go away when an economic shock happens. And that's not always a bad thing, right? I mean, it's tough and uncomfortable and all of that, but sometimes it's sort of like cleaning out, the types of enterprises whose time has passed. But if you don't have that group of younger companies that are doing things in a different way to come in behind it, you end up being in a much more extractive position. You end up being in a situation where rural communities were suddenly the place that were housing chains, and for retail, and were not being able to produce their own goods and services at the same level. And automation had its upsides, right? It created millions and millions of jobs in the United States, while it was also removing millions and millions of jobs. The problem is it almost exclusively created them in urban places and almost exclusively removed them in rural. And as a result, we saw the biggest divide emerge in 2010, 11, 12, 13, 14, in 60, 70 years. And it all happened very quietly. There was not a lot of reporting about it, even though I think many of us look back to the farm crisis as being the huge hit on rural America, and was seen as this sort of Armageddon of the economy of rural. Even during the height of the farm crisis, you didn't see a net loss in rural population. Population was still growing in rural America, here and there. Many parts, it was because of the Latino community that was growing, but it was still continuing to grow. 2011, 12, 13, 14, and 15 all saw net losses in population. And there is nothing like feeling the experience of there being fewer people in your community year over year to contribute to that overall malaise. The local market-focused businesses continue to struggle because They have a smaller market to sell to in their immediate vicinity. And the people who left weren't all the same. It was mostly people with a college degree, and those with debt were much more likely to move to urban places than rural places. So, but that's the real origin to this. You also had combined with it the disruption of voice. You literally had at the same moment the mechanisms that rural people felt like they could have a voice in society evaporate. You had, televisions stations were being shut down in rural places. Small newspapers were going under on a regular basis. And you definitely felt a disconnect in most of rural America between what you saw on CNN or Fox News and what you were living in your own community. And I believe that really contributed to the overall divide, both in terms of the economy, but also in people believing that we were living on two different planets, and that's what's particularly concerning to me.
So what do you see as being necessary to happen in order to begin to rather reverse that or redress the imbalance?
The silverish bullet, right? And it's not the only solution, but one that we feel is absolutely critical, is to build digital economy jobs in rural places. And the reason is that those are the fruits of automation. Automation is not slowing down. In fact, in COVID, it's only accelerating, right? It actually went from being something that was about being able to save money and producing a good or a service to being something that also could keep people from having to be in physical contact with each other. And so the innovations in automation over the last year have been phenomenal. And we're going to see that in the type of recovery that we have, where many of the jobs are just simply not going to come back. So we believe that it is imperative that you have some ownership of production in the age of automation in rural places, all the way across the country. And our North Star that we focus on is that rural America represents 15% of the nation's workforce, but only 5% of the digital economy jobs. And that in order to be able to get to a place of equity in terms of economic mobility, since these are the jobs that actually allow people to accelerate their income very quickly, but also in terms of resilience, you have to get that 5% up to 15%. Now, that doesn't mean that all digital economy jobs have to be in rural or all rural jobs have to be digital economy jobs. It just has to be a portion of it. And then I think rural America has a chance of actually having a renaissance because it has all kinds of other things that balance that economy and make living there, I think, much more attractive in many ways. So having an agriculture sector, having a forestry sector, having advanced manufacturing in places then can be a part of it. But if you don't have that core, which is driving the changes in automation and owning part of that and having companies that are built that are actually putting those things together, it will become more extractive again. And that's when rural places, get into trouble. But so that's our silver bullet. Lots of other things have to happen: investment in education, figuring out how to retrain people. But the big one that I wasn't counting on was the need for systems change, including policy and perhaps more importantly, narrative shift. And this is what we have ended up spending a lot more time and energy on than I would have ever anticipated. Since, I had the good fortune and privilege of growing up in a rural place. And, one of my first jobs was working for a software company based in Wilder, Vermont, that, two guys stood up to solve a problem in the commercial printing industry. And, we I joined about 10 years into the company's existence, and we grew it to over 100 employees serving commercial printers all over the world. And so the idea that you had to be in an urban place in order to solve a market problem with technology just never occurred to me. But it got so into people's view of the world, of what you could do in one place and you couldn't do in another place, that it over the last couple of years, we've been astounded by how much work we have to do to actually show that, yes, entrepreneurs in rural places can do technology and find solutions to market problems, that people can transition from other kinds of jobs into coding and other things, just like they can in cities where they have, boot camps doing that on a day-to-day basis.
The question of urban and rural futures has also been on the mind of Paul Costello, who has headed up the Vermont Council on Rural Development for the past 21 years and will be retiring on September 30th. He and his team have led numerous community visits to communities around Vermont over that time, and he obtained a unique perspective on what makes rural communities tick. And,
in the Depression there, Vermont, there's a sort of Vermont saying that when the stock market crashed and we went into Depression, people in other places, in more urban places, were seeing, this shocking set of changes. And in Vermont, people were saying, what Depression? It's kind of like normal. And I think that there are, systematic changes. And you brought up the change that happened in the late 60s and early 70s when a lot of young people moved to Vermont. There was the Back to the Land movement, but it wasn't all about the land. It was also about creatives looking to connect to real community and to connect to nature. And I think that was a foundation for a lot of change and growth in Vermont. And, people sometimes, think that the economy is flattened out or that, we often define rural as deficit, like it's not developed yet or it's not what it could be. And yet we need to appreciate what it also is, which is a repository for nature, a repository for small towns and community, repository for agriculture, for energy development, for the outdoor recreation economy. And all those things were spurred by the 1960s and 70s movement to Vermont too. Not just people moving to the land to start new dairy farms, because we have seen a decline in the number of dairy farms over time, but people with really creative ideas, like Ben and Jerry, like the folks that built the Garden Way. There was a lot of things like that, and yogurt production in Vermont, and cheese makers in general, the growth of Cabot, and then since then, the diversity of cheeses. And so, we often think of the loss of youth as sort of a deep challenge, and it is, and the challenge of workforce is important too. But we need to recognize that there are youth who choose to stay, and there are other youth that are attracted to Vermont because their interest in entrepreneurism or their interest in vocation connects to the food system movement or to the development of new breweries in Vermont or to the outdoor recreation economy. And you see what's going on in towns like Randolph and Montgomery and Burke, and all across the state there's this movement of people who are getting back to the land for recreational business development and to make Vermont a mecca for mountain biking and backcountry skiing. And all that has been going on steadily for years, and with the pandemic you're seeing a deep hunger, a national hunger, especially among young people, but really for all of us, to have natural experiences, to get outside, to connect to nature in any number of ways. And so there's a great opportunity for that. When you talk to Matt Dunn at Cori, you get a real clear sense of the opportunity for people who can work in rural communities. They can live, people can live anywhere in the world and participate in the global economy if they have good internet service. And we're getting there, and we're going to complete the loop for broadband, I think, in the next few years. And in doing so, we make rural communities even more dynamic places for next generation people who are looking to develop businesses. They can work in San Francisco or Mumbai from their home. And I think that we're seeing that now. We're seeing it with co-working spaces that have sprung up over the last 5 years throughout Vermont. We're seeing it with home-based businesses that have sprung up in people managing stock portfolios for others from their hilltop house, or they're doing graphics, or they're producing video games. The diversity of creativity that happens right now that's pretty invisible, unless you're really digging, is really pretty impressive. Other young people are moving here because they want to connect to the food systems movement. And we know the story of Hardwick, the town that food saved. But it's not just Hardwick. All over the state, there are food hubs that have grown. There's people looking really diligently at the diversification of agriculture and what are the next stage opportunities. You know, someone's growing saffron in Vermont. You know, who would have thought? Other people are looking at the different ways that you can use what was commodity in terms of, you know, what are the different values to dairy and how do we boost cheeses and yogurts and ice creams and that kind of step-by-step process of adding value to the commodity so you can control the price, you can capture more of the value of the material, and you can find new and creative markets. All that stuff has been happening very steadily, and there's a lot of really creative people in Vermont. The other kinds of people that stay and that are part of rural, sometimes we don't value enough the fact that we still have community banks and community credit unions, and there's dollars to invest in rural communities. We have really creative philanthropy in Vermont. It's small, but it's vital and it's essential to the state. And I think that people don't often look at how all those pieces of fabric connect to opportunities. But it's all around us. You know, when you go to communities in Vermont, you know there's challenges, but you also see a lot of vitality in terms of arts and creativity. You know, one of the things that's interesting about Vermont is the number of people who move to Vermont because they're writers. They want to connect to a landscape. They want to connect deeply to a sense of place. And they choose, you know, and maybe they're introverts who like to, you know, work out in the hill and have time to reflect. But there's a lot of those people. And there's a lot of artists. You know, the Northeast Kingdom has done some great studies in the Arts Council in Vermont of the proportion of creatives in Vermont versus the national economy. And it's high. Something like 9% of the workforce is working in the creative economy. They're everything from of game developers to artists, to writers, to performers. And they choose to live in a place that provides a deep sense of home. And nationally, you look at rural, and you've got to say, rural is the repository of clean water. It's the repository of our nature and of natural experiences. It's also the foundation of the national energy economy. It's the foundation of where our food, fiber, forest products, what, you know, wood comes from. It's really the natural resource center for the country, and it's dispersed. So it doesn't aggregate. It doesn't have as pointed a story as what goes on in Cambridge, Massachusetts, or LA. But there's this diffuse process of creativity that's all over this country right now. And if you look town to town, you know, James Fallows just did that remarkable book and study on Vermont Public TV and other places, describing the vitality of small towns. And there's a reason people are here. You know, there's a reason people are here.
In the second part of this two-part series, we'll hear from Peter Radford, an economist who is a frequent speaker at events held by the Green Mountain Academy for Lifelong Learning, and also from Jesse Piles, the executive director of Smoky House in Danby, and who hails from West Virginia, a state that has also grappled with shifting economic, political, and cultural influences in recent decades. For now, and for the GNet TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.
Thanks for listening local. For more local content, visit GNAT.tv.